It's Monday, January 24th. We need tests to go back to work, but none of the workers who deliver tests can go to work. We start here. As employers struggle to fill the gaps, COVID is affecting everything from your 401k to your tax refund.
This year is going to be even more complicated than last year.
We'll tell you what you need to know about your financial health. If there's not going to be a war over Ukraine, why is the U.S. clearing out its embassy?
I don't know whether you heard that there. We just heard a gunshot.
Our team was literally in the trenches. And all the police know is that a young woman died during a date. So why is that all they know?
You expect the police to follow protocol.
One family says they have an idea and they're ready to sue over it. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. If someone's got COVID in your community right now, the overwhelming chances are that it's the Omicron variant. And what's been so game-changing about this variant is how easily vaccinated people can transmit it. In the span of one month, breakthrough cases among fully vaccinated people rose fourfold, which has made some people say, well, you know, what is the point of vaccines if they don't keep you from getting the virus? But late last week, for the very first time, the CDC put out cold, hard numbers showing what the Omicron surge has looked like for vaccinated versus unvaccinated people. Here's what they found out.
Overall, for those who received a booster dose, had the most protection against emergency room visits, urgent care clinic visits, and hospitalizations.
First of all, this idea that the vaccine doesn't protect you from getting Omicron, that's just not true. But Brad, you say, you just told us a vaccinated person was four times more likely to get a breakthrough case. Yes, that's right. But the thing is, in that 1 month span, unvaccinated people were 14 times more likely to get infected. Second, doctors have been telling us that hospitalization numbers were just night and day between these two groups, and it turns out they were right. In fact, unvaccinated people were more than 50 times more likely to die from COVID last month than someone who had gotten that full booster regimen. Let me say that again. I'm not saying 50% more likely. I'm saying 50 times more likely. As in, for one vaccinated person who died from COVID, 50 unvaccinated Americans died. And yet, there is no doubt, even less severe cases of COVID are still wreaking havoc on our country, and especially on our economy.
I will hire 10 workers today, but then I will have a call from about 6 later tonight saying, I had an exposure, I have a fever, my throat hurts, I just tested positive.
And as last week progressed, Americans could just see in real time their retirement accounts shrinking before their eyes. I want to bring in ABC's business correspondent Deirdre Bolton to start us off this week. Deirdre, for like the last week, we've seen the stock market just take this dive. I know stocks don't always tell the story of the wider economy, but what do they tell us here about what is going on?
There is a lot going on. And you just mentioned the retirement accounts. This week, the average American 401k retirement account lost more than $7,300. I mean, you said at the Dow in 1 week, down 1,700 points. You have to go back to the early days of the pandemic to see the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ perform that poorly. Dow and S&P, third straight week of losses.
So we're seeing this rotation out of most sectors that are consumer facing, out of big tech where the big growth was, out of the stay-at-home stocks that did well during the pandemic to safety stocks and energy stocks.
There were some earnings disappointments from companies like Netflix and Peloton, so that was part of it. And listen, there's tons of companies that are still dealing with supply chain issues, and that's affecting, to a certain extent, the way that they do business.
With elevated inflation pressures and a rapidly strengthening labor market, the economy no longer needs increasing amounts of policy support.
And then the other factor that's really weighing heavily on investors' minds is that the Fed is going to meet this week and may move that benchmark rate higher. Now, if somebody's wondering, why does this affect me? Why do I care? That rate really determines all borrowing costs. So any mortgage, any car loan, any business loan, it basically determines the price of borrowing money. So it's pretty important. Investors are pretty focused on that.
So investors kind of jittery about that. But let's talk about the supply chain, because I feel like that strikes the jitters into like so many people. Last year, we were talking about companies not being able to hire people back fast enough. Now, I feel like even if you've hired a bunch of people, there's no guarantee they're all going to be working for you next week. They might all get sick with COVID and call out. Like, how big are supply chain issues and workforce issues as we try to round the corner on this?
Brad, this is huge. You have some companies unofficially telling us up to 30% of their workforce is sick with coronavirus. That has huge implications.
One top economist warns absent employees could, quote, deal a significant hit to the economy over the next month or two.
For so many companies, Brad, the ability to test their workers, have everybody feel safe and secure in their workforce is so important. And supply chain issues are even affecting those companies.
In California, new video showing tens of millions of rapid tests just waiting to ship out of this warehouse.
iHealth is a company that makes at-home tests for coronavirus. 17 million tests were stuck in a warehouse in LA. Three charter planes carrying up to 25 million tests were delayed.
We're talking about millions and millions of tests.
Correct. We hope that these weapons can be delivered to the battlefield as soon as possible.
So that company is dealing with its own supply chain issues, workers calling out sick with coronavirus, bottlenecked warehouses already operating over capacity to handle massive demand for these tests. We know the U.S. government essentially wants every single household that asks for tests to get them.
Hey, the other thing here, as we work forward into the new economic year, I guess, the other thing that almost slipped by me today, Deirdre, was today's kind of the first real day of the tax filing season. And the only reason I know that is not because I get my taxes done very early. It's because tax experts say this year might be even worse to file your taxes than last year. Why?
So the IRS is facing its own set of challenges this year. There are workers with coronavirus who are sick. The agency is also still dealing with a backlog from last year.
The agency has not been equipped with the resources it needs to adequately serve taxpayers in normal times, let alone during a pandemic.
So yes, this year is going to be even more complicated than last year. There's two main reasons for that. One is the expanded child credit. And this is really the big one. Families with children started to be paid in July 2021. So basically, families got half of what they can claim for the year for their children.
People have written to me to tell me they use the money to buy their kids new shoes, to send them to summer camp, cover after school care.
So the idea was to get money into the hands of families that needed it, but it does create more paperwork.
You provide correct information so that you will not be exposed to any additional delays.
Experts say it's really important to correctly report the money received so far. That's going to come via a letter from the IRS. But if it's not correctly recorded, the money you've already received, there is a risk to a lengthy delay when it comes to receiving your tax refund.
Oh, like if you don't fill it out right the first time, you could be looking at a delayed refund.
That's exactly right, Brad. So people are going to have to fill out a file, and parents basically need to watch the mail for a letter from the IRS, and they have to reconcile what they received in advance with what they are owed. The other thing, Brad, I should mention is the timing. There's no extension this year. April 18th, that's the day. It's set in stone.
Right, April 18th. Although, again, that creates this sort of crush of people all around one time of the year, in which case, you know, refunds could get delayed either because of that or because people are, you know, getting confused on some of their forms. Either way, you know, real money that Americans want back in their pocket could be sitting in the pockets of the government for a little while longer than usual. All right. Deirdre Bolton, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Next up on Start Here, the U.S. is prepping for a war. Some Ukrainians think they're already in one. Our team heads to the front after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off,
an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
There are lots of clues about the escalating conflict between Russia and Ukraine right now. People make careers out of reading the tea leaves from the Kremlin, trying to figure out whether Vladimir Putin might invade one of his neighbors. But the best way to tell, of course, is what's actually happening on the ground.
He said if without Ukraine, Russia will lose its empire. It can't be an empire.
Don't know whether you heard that there. We just heard a gunshot.
And recently, ABC's Patrick Reval, who's usually based in Moscow, traveled to Ukraine and went to what is already the front lines of a battle, but that could be the front lines of a potential war with Russia. He's in Ukraine as we speak right now. Patrick, you were telling me last week Ukrainians weren't even particularly worried about a war then. Are they worried more now?
Hi, Brad. You know, it's a very interesting question. If you ask most people on the street, they will say that they don't believe that the Russians are really going to launch a major invasion. They still think it's just flexing muscles and trying to intimidate.
Psychologically, I'm ready for a war. As for the other preparations, no, not really. I haven't taken any specific action yet, but psychologically, yes.
And one of the reasons that Ukrainians are perhaps not as worried as Americans looking on is because ultimately they've been dealing with this for 8 years. Their country's been at war for 8 years, because there is this conflict in the east of the country between government soldiers and Russian-controlled separatist rebels.
Do you think there is a bigger chance that Russia will try to invade?
Basically, yeah.
But, you know, we did go to the front line, as you say. When we were talking to the troops out there, there was a bit of a difference, a little bit.
I'm sure that Russia, if they come here, they come further. And I think
they wouldn't stop here. They go further into Ukraine.
I think probably they stand near the Dnipro River.
That's near Kiev.
Yeah.
So we went to a place called Avdiivka, which is an industrial town in the east of Ukraine. And the front line in Ukraine is obviously where the Ukrainian government is fighting with these Russian-controlled rebel separatists.
This area is eerily quiet at the moment, but every now and again we hear the sound of gunshots. Although there's supposed to be a ceasefire, this fighting has really never stopped.
The Ukrainian soldiers are dug into these warehouses and also into trenches that really look like something out of the First World War.
Mind your head.
You know, you're kind of wandering through these fields and through these sort of 2 meter, 4 meter deep trenches and going into dugouts.
Can I look through the periscope?
Yeah, of course.
My colleague Ian Pannell asked the Ukrainian officer that we were with what would happen if we weren't in the dugout.
If we stood up there, what would happen?
Probably we will be killed by a sniper. Because
it's that serious, that close?
Yeah.
How close is the enemy?
The enemy is maybe 200... 200 meters.
Yes.
So one of the people we met when we were at the front was the top commander of the entire Eastern Front line. His name is Lieutenant General Alexander Pavlyuk.
Vladimir Putin says there are no Russians here. You don't believe him?
You think it's not true?
Not true.
Not true.
But he said he was absolutely certain that Russia wants to try and take control of Ukraine by some means, or either by military or by destabilization. He said right now he estimated there are 127,000 troops, Russian troops, massed on the border.
We have different attitudes to our soldiers' lives. You know, the Russians are willing to lose, they don't care how many people they lose in this war, whereas we care for every life of every soldier.
He said the best way to deter Putin was for Western countries to supply more military aid. Essentially, this is something you hear a lot from Ukrainians, is that they don't believe in this idea of avoiding provoking Russia. They feel that Russia in this situation can't be provoked, it can only be deterred, and therefore they think the best thing that Western countries can do to try and help Ukraine is just to provide more military aid, which the U.S. is doing.
What we were doing is testing whether there is still a path forward for diplomacy, for dialogue, to resolve a crisis that Russia has created by massing 100,000 forces on Ukraine's border and threatening to renew its aggression against Ukraine.
So then you leave the front lines, and still back in Kiev and back in Moscow and back in Washington, D.C., things are still happening. What are the most significant developments in your mind over this past weekend?
In terms of other major things that are happening, definitely right now we are seeing a shift in the amount of military support that is being sent to Ukraine. The U.S. is sending large amounts of ammunition mainly, but also increasingly anti-tank missiles.
More weapons being transferred to Ukraine from the Baltic states. This has come with American approval.
We also saw the U.S. importantly allowing other European countries to begin delivering American-made weapons. In particular, Lithuania is being allowed to send Stinger missiles, which are anti-aircraft missiles. In the past, the Russians have said is a total red line.
Tonight, the U.S. government expected to formally tell Americans in Ukraine to get out.
Another major development is that the U.S. is beginning to pull out some of its diplomats from Ukraine over security fears. It's beginning to authorize non-emergency personnel and diplomats' families to leave Ukraine. And this obviously sends a pretty worrying signal in the sense that it looks like the U.S. believes that a major Russian attack is much more likely or is becoming more likely.
The whole world is screaming that Russia escalates, while Russia makes a fool of the whole world.
What the Ukrainians are particularly worried about is that potentially Western countries could find themselves almost doing Russia's job for it by essentially falling for this intimidation and kind of overhyping almost the threat of invasion.
Right, in a country where it feels like a perpetual war, you know, an embassy clearing out might not mean that much. But for the U.S., who's had intelligence services looking at this, the U.S. sounds more and more convinced that Russia will do at least something to provoke what could be a significant conflict. Patrick Grevel, thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
We've seen several cases in recent years involving women who are missing or dead, whose families say they are not given nearly enough information about their loved ones, that they're not taken seriously, that they're brushed off. Some of those families have said, specifically even within this group, Black and brown women are at the bottom of the priority list. Well, recently in Bridgeport, Connecticut, a family of a young Black woman says her death has been treated as nothing more than an afterthought. ABC's Sabina Gepper-Medin joins us. Sabina, this is a woman who was last seen on a date with a man she met on a dating app?
Well, it's still very much a mystery. Lauren Smith Fields was found dead after she went on a date with an older man. She was only 23 years old, a Black woman, and she was found dead the morning after the date.
Well, and according to police, right, this man claims they were together. She swung outside real quick to meet someone. She comes back. She uses the bathroom. Then they keep hanging out like everything's normal. He then claims he wakes up to her dead in bed next to him. Do we know how she died, though?
We know very little right now because the manner and cause of death is still pending, and so is the toxicology report. But her family is saying that the Bridgeport police have failed in properly investigating her case and have violated the family's civil rights.
If someone passes away in your jurisdiction, no matter where you are, under these circumstances, you expect the police to follow protocol. And if that's not done, it really lends or begs the question as to whether the police are really working for this family.
They're saying that the police also has been racially insensitive towards them and treating them with no respect as they grieve and search for answers.
And it seems like there's two countries within one. When you have the same scenario where the victim is a white person, you get the Gabby Petito treatment, where there's helicopters all over, there's a national search, Amber Alerts. And now here, it's almost like they look to us to prove our own case.
Yeah, can you dig more into that? Like, from their view, what is the family hoping to hear? What do they think hasn't been done that should be done?
Well, we spoke to Lauren's brother over the weekend, and he is very upset. He's been one of the strong voices, you know, calling for justice in her name.
We're looking for an independent investigation. And what we want is justice. We want answers.
And he's told us that it's not just about Lauren. It's about every girl that could potentially go through something like this.
We're going to continue to keep her name alive. And we're going to continue to push pressure on the police, on the city, and whoever needs pressure put on them. That's what we're going to do.
he doesn't want this to happen to anybody else. He doesn't want anyone to feel this pain. It's about being treated equally and with respect.
The other names that come to mind in the last year, Sabina, are, I'm thinking about Gabby Petito. I'm thinking about Vanessa Guillen, you know, families that essentially said, no, 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 we are going to make more noise about this because we don't think it's gotten the media attention it deserves. And we just don't think it's gotten the police work that, should be done. How is that kind of informing what is happening on social media right now?
And the social media uproar in this case have been tremendous. You have seen it on TikTok. You've seen it on Instagram.
This beautiful girl deserves her name to be everywhere.
She cannot be forgotten. Lauren Smith Fields. Lauren Smith Fields.
Everyone is talking about this case. You know, of course, we see the hashtag, you know, protect black women.
Remember Gabby Petito in this situation. She deserves the same amount of coverage.
And I think social media has really garnished a lot of attention in this case and helped this case. But we still have to note that we're still waiting for the final report from the chief medical examiner's office for cause and manner of death, and also the toxicology report. And that's really important.
Well, and so the family apparently seems to be considering suing, right? They issued this formal notice that you have to issue in Connecticut ahead of any potential lawsuit. What is the police department in Bridgeport saying about this? You talked to them, right?
Yes. The police have been telling me that this is an ongoing and active case. And earlier this month, the Bridgeport police said that they take these concerns very seriously. And the command staff of the Detective Bureau is reviewing the handling of this case to ensure the best practices were being followed. However, the family marched yesterday calling for justice in Lauren's name. And they say that the police have been racially insensitive towards them and treating them with no respect. So they keep marching and asking for justice in her name.
And the man who was with her gave his report to the police but has not commented to ABC News. Sabina Gebermedin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take one more quick break. When we come back, if you wanted to see why the global supply chain is so messed up, welcome to a real lockdown. One Last Thing is next.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing.
In the face of the pandemic, all residents have to make sacrifices.
The leader of Hong Kong has not been very popular lately, and that's before she came for everyone's pets.
I understand pet owners will be unhappy, but we have no choice.
For the last week, officials have been demanding Hong Kong residents turn in their pet hamsters to be exterminated. It's all in response to one positive test case in a pet shop. A worker tested positive. They tested the animals. A few hamsters tested positive for COVID. Cut to the order for a full-on hamster cull.
People were asked to surrender any hamsters bought on or after December 22nd.
Well, yesterday, officials said out of the 2,000 pet hamsters they'd collected, there had been one positive case.
I think it's unethical, and it's not right to kill just all the hamster.
Animal rights experts have been furious, saying these numbers prove how rare animal-to-human transmission actually is. But this shows how far-reaching China's so-called zero-COVID policy has become.
140 new infections were reported in Hong Kong on Sunday. And there are no signs of the government easing the restrictions.
At this point, a single case can result in a district or even just a building being completely locked off from the world for days at a time. You're not allowed to leave your building for groceries. You can't even leave if you don't live in that building. One woman went viral describing being on a blind date and then being suddenly told to quarantine with this stranger for nearly a week. That did not end with a love connection, but another Chinese pair was stuck together for 20 days, and they have now announced their engagement. Not such happy times for these hamster owners. Also, not such happy times for economists who say if you shut down an entire Chinese city over one COVID cluster, that could actually screw up the supply chain for a big chunk of the world. In the case of a poor developing community, that could lead to even worse health outcomes over there. Hey, if you have not rated and reviewed the show, it truly helps us out. Or if you're old school, word of mouth works for us, just tell that friend in your life who needs a little more current events knowledge to subscribe. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.